to the Common Geeking Program, a book club podcast where each week three of us read up on a topic and discuss it from a geeky, nerdy perspective.
Nervy.
This week, two of us will be pitted against one another in a head-to-head versus episode. I'm your referee, your host, your leader, your god, Keenan Konish, and today's fight will be between...
You added God to that script. I did not put God in
the
script.
You're right, because not everyone is God. Boom. Science.
Okay, sorry, yeah, that's a very general script.
Sorry, boom, theology.
Hi, I'm Laura. I guess I'm here today. We're not sure yet, though.
Good start, guys. Glad we're... Okay.
No. Hello.
Hello.
Today, I will be here representing the 2001 Ernest Cline novel Ready Player One.
Whoa. Hold on.
2011. Sorry.
There you go.
It was in front of my face, and I don't know where 2009 came from, so this is going to be very good.
You said 2001, and then 2011.
Did I really?
And then 2009.
Oh, Jesus.
You're already slipping. Demerit.
So the good news is that I'm not expecting to do particularly well today.
All right, cool. So you can always come back and surprise us.
We good.
Clearly, you're just trying to buy me off by, like, setting the bar low so we can be impressed by you, but whatever.
Yeah, that counts as buying you off and not hustling. Okay. My name is Colin Ketchin, and as the combatant against Laura today, I will be representing Ready Player One, the 2018 feature film directed by Steven Spielberg, also written by Ernest Cline, but also Zach Penn.
Cool.
Penn the pen. Penn penned the pen.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's going to be a long night.
I have listened to the audiobook twice. I could host a whole episode on whether or not reading versus listening to an audiobook is a thing, but I will not. But I have read this book twice.
Hell yeah.
And this morning I went out and saw Ready Player One in theaters in 3D. So I have both read the book and seen the movie.
In 3D, yeah.
I recently read the book in 2D. I couldn't get my hands on a 3D copy of the book, so I just read it in 2D.
It is 3D, though, because it's a book.
I read on my iPad.
Your iPad is 3D. She has a point.
It is still 3D.
I was only half making a joke. I only read the book. No, it's the information is presented in two dimensions, despite the dimension of the iPad itself. So I read the book. I blew through it in, like, you know, not that long. And then I finished it right before the movie came out. I saw the movie in IMAX 3D on the preview night. Holy fuck. It looks really good. It's very pretty. So I'm a little rustier than Laura on some points because this is being recorded on April 7th. So I saw it like a week and a half ago.
Each representative will have a few minutes to describe their domain and make their case before we launch into a lengthy debate.
That was my nickname in high school.
Of which I will be the judge. When the dust has settled, I shall name a victor of this intense and bloody affair. I will judge your arguments based on various criteria. I will ask you questions and then see how you respond to them.
Cool.
I want you to be able to defend your point accurately with evidence.
Ooh, evidence.
This is going to be bad for me because in front of my eyes, it says 2011, and apparently I don't know how to read and or use my brain. So accuracy is going to be an issue for me today.
So even if you're presented with the right evidence, you still might fuck it up pretty hard.
Oh, yeah. 100%. That is what just happened. Yes.
Just give me the gold star now and I can go to bed. I work in the morning. Let's just call it.
The book is still better.
Okay.
Oh, well, I guess it's done. Let's end the episode now. It's over.
There we go.
Gold star Laura.
So I guess, yeah, we should probably mention that the debate today in this versus episode is that Laura believes the book Ready Player One is better than the film. And I believe the film is better than the book. And I think Keenan's...
Well, I believe that both are objectively things. Yeah, that's right. Let's begin on that subject. All right, so Laura, what's your thing? Like, tell me about it. Tell me what is it a book? Is it a paper? Is it a tome? Is it a scroll? Is it in English? Tell me about it.
I would say that it is a book and it is in English, but also probably translated into other things as well. And by things, I mean languages.
It does have some Elvish.
I believe you. Because I definitely read it.
It does. It just does. He even says it. They speak the Sindarin tongue, the language of the gray elves, the ones that didn't fucking migrate to Valinor. God damn it.
Okay.
Sure.
So the... This is such a shit show already. I'm so sorry. All right. So the book Ready Player One was written in 2011. I know these things because it says it in my notes in front of my face, by Ernest Cline. The premise is that it is a nostalgia-filled romp through the 80s where in the future, the world has essentially gone to shit. Everybody is devastated. There's no money for transportation anymore. Gas doesn't exist. There's an energy crisis. And so humanity moved to the Oasis, which is an online world built by Halliday, who was a video game designer who started a gregarious games company. He basically just made a very in-depth, intensive, all-immersive world called the Oasis, which was virtual reality, where you could be anyone, do anything, go anywhere.
The Oasis is an acronym for ontologically anthropocentric sensory immersive simulation.
Sounds made up, but all right.
It is a book. Everything is made up.
By Ernest Cline.
Everything is made up.
So the Oasis is this incredible, vast world that anyone can basically do anything. It started out more as a game idea and then turned into basically the whole world where people go to work and play and go to school and have fun and dance and all this stuff. It is society at this point. So James Halliday dies and does not have an heir. And so in his will, he lays out a incredibly complicated Easter egg hunt for his final Easter egg. And whoever gets that egg at the end of this hunt wins his entire fortune and the rights to owning the Gregarious Simulations company.
Is it an actual egg?
It is.
Not quite.
Will it hatch you a small chick? No. So that's your definition of egg.
I mean, neither will echidna eggs, but okay.
All right.
So some of these things about this book, I guess I have time to kind of go through the plot a little bit. Basically, there are three keys. Each key leads to a gate, and whoever gets through the third gate wins the competition. Whoever gets through it first wins the competition. And the people that are hunting for this egg are called egg hunters or gunters.
Gunter!
Oh, Gunter! You took my stuff!
Wank. And then everyone else is a filthy casual who just lives and shops in the simulation.
There's actual people named Gunther. Wank. That must be tough.
Well, it's not Gunther, it's Gunter, because egg hunter.
Wank.
Oh.
Gunter. Wank. Like the musician. Was Gunter the one that did Sexy for My Shirt? I don't know. Maybe not. That was
maybe. I don't remember. Wank. I will take issue with the fact that I think that Gunter is a really stupid word. And it says it a lot in the book. So I wasn't such a huge fan.
It says it a lot, but like I will also say that, you know, as a gamer, we also have some other just pretty dumb terms in general. So I can't fault dumbness for that. I can fault a lot of other things. Anyway, continue.
So Wade Watts is our main character. He is a 17-year-old, I believe, senior in high school. He's going to school in the Oasis. Very poor and lives in the Stacks, which is basically... mobile homes built into really tiny stacks.
It's that Burger King thing with four patties.
Sure. Yep. He just lives inside of that. It's greasy all the time. All the time.
And that's why the movie's better than the book. You get that sweet, sweet grease all over your IMAX eyes.
Would be better if it had smell-o-vision. Anyway.
Sprayed at you.
So the hunt has been going on for 5 years. Wade is a huge gunter, so he takes incredible intensive notes and studies everything about Halliday and his interests and his passions, his work, his personal life.
Creepy.
Which is what all the gunters are doing so they can know the most about Halliday to beat his game. And Wade is the first person to realize when he's sitting in school one day that the first key is actually on the planet that has all of the schools on it, named Ludus.
Which is Latin for learning,
yep.
I think.
Smart, smart.
I learned that from the book.
Yeah. And so he's actually able to get the first key. He's the first person to get the first key and make it through the first gate.
It's worth noting that he has like really shitty social status and economic status. So the fact that he found it is like, how did this fucking loser?
Quick question.
Yep.
Can anyone find the key? Like, is there multiple keys?
Yes.
Like, okay.
So there are multiple copies of the key.
Okay.
Think of it like an MMO. One person gets it, somebody else can go and get it after that. So it's like whoever gets them all first.
Yeah.
All right, because I was a little confused. I was like, well, if you have the key to the first door, just keep that one.
Not gonna lie, yeah. I thought that when I read the book.
Joke's on you guys. You can't even make it to the third door.
There's a plot point where there's a company called IOI, which is
Innovative Online Industries.
Thank you. Oh. Which is like a huge internet provider and also a really big company that deals with a lot of shit going on. They're like the second biggest company in the world after Gregarious Simulations. And they are the evil corporation. You're giving me weird looks.
Oh, I'm just making faces. Okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't looking at you. I was looking at my Skype window.
So they're the bad guy in this series. So they're the big corporate people that are trying to take over the Oasis and charge people. Oh, the Oasis is free, or you pay 25 cents at the very beginning and that's it. Everything else is free within it until you buy.
Like Pornhub Premium.
Right. You pay to play.
Whoa, that must be crazy.
But IOI wants to take over. And so they have a huge army of what they call Sixers, because they only go by their employee ID number, that are basically faceless, nameless people that are just trying to force their way through to win this company, or win the hunt so that they can take over the company.
Nice, nice.
This is taking much longer than I expected it to. Basically, Wade has to pair up with a couple of other people who are also Gunters to try to save the Oasis from IOI, this evil corporation. And they go through many different challenges, and IOI kills Wade's aunt by blowing up the stacks, trying to get him to not be able to continue the hunt because he was the first person to get the key.
Wow.
And so the stakes are really high. Some of the reasons that I think that the book is better than the movie. First of all, the book had such specific and rich imagery in it the whole time that it should have been a very good transition over to a movie. Colin is making faces at me and I am very distracted.
It's fine. Keep going.
Opening remarks. It's fine. Keep it civil.
Because it had you literally are fucking me up right now. It had a lot of imagery in it, and I think that they could have really drawn from that a little bit more than they did. And it's also about really just like smart kids that are working really hard to gain knowledge and skills about a specific area. And they work at it. Like you spend a lot of time, which I realize doesn't necessarily translate over to movie as well, but they spend a lot of time like doing research and figuring out the best way to do things and strategizing and really digging into it as like a complicated problem that they have to solve. It's a little bit of a coming of age story, I would say. And part of that is being intelligent, being resourceful. And I felt like in the book, they were that. And all of these kids that are, you know, trying to win this huge stakes war, basically, were super smart and really, like, took intelligent risks. And in the movie, it felt like they were just really lucky. And, like, they spent some time doing some research, but, like, they just got lucky a bunch. And, like, you know, I think that having a role model of intelligence and research is really important.
Yeah, so you're saying that the movie streamlined aspects of the book and ended up watering down some of what you believe made the book successful.
Yeah, I would say that. And I also think the movie did look really beautiful, but like the whole book is intentionally 80s nostalgia. And I felt like they really didn't use that to its fullest advantage in the movie. Like they had such an opportunity to, and like it just didn't really happen for me.
All right.
Colin is going to have some things to say about that, but we will argue about that shortly.
Now, Colin, let's hear from you and your perspective on the movie. The moving picture. Was it in sound? Was it a talkie?
Unfortunately, this was not a talkie, and I was so distracted by the color that I did bring basically cellophane to filter out the color in front of my 3T glasses so I could get the true 1920s movie effect I knew Spielberg was going for with this 20s nostalgia motion picture.
Nice.
You're right.
So, the movie, Ready Player One.
Of course, Ready Player One.
The movie of Ready Player One takes place in the same setting as the book. It's the same main character, Wade Watts. He lives in the stacks. He's very impoverished. James Halliday created the Oasis. All this stuff is still true. The actual plot of the movie and the video game challenges presented in which you earn the keys and earn the gates have all been fucking changed.
Yeah.
Like, the plot is loosely the same, but it is remarkably different. And honestly, I think that that works very well in the movie's favor. because the movie does not have the time to go through all this remarkably dense trivia that the book does, and it gets you right into the action. So in the book, you have like a Dungeons and Dragons thing and then an arcade game, and that's the first key. And then they watch the movie War Games, and that's the first gate. So it's like, even that would be a lot of time. War Games itself is a pretty long movie, and I didn't want to pay to see War Games in IMAX 3D.
War Games is great.
It was a good movie, but it's not optimized for that theater format.
Matthew Broderick, please add me on Facebook. Thank you.
Matthew Broderick.
Oh, he listens to the podcast now.
He does. This is great. So the movie, the book takes about 5 or 6 chapters, and they're not long chapters, but 5 or 6 chapters painting, hey, this is the Oasis, this is my planet, this is how I discovered the first key. And all that stuff. And the movie literally starts like 5 minutes of voiceover exposition, which honestly was not as chunky as I thought.
No, they did a pretty good job there.
Wade explaining the world in 5 minutes worked pretty well. It didn't feel clunky. It felt personal, and that was nice. And it just jumps straight into the first challenge, which is a giant crazy race with the Jurassic Park T-Rex and King Kong and all these video game references and all these things just all over the place. And it's just very dense and very action-packed. So Wade Watts and his avatar Parzival in the book encountered the character of Artemis after beating the first gate. But in the movie, like, you meet Artemis, you meet H, you meet, like, all these characters that took several chapters of the book to unfold. You meet them right off the bat. And I think the movie had to get off to that start just to try and get the action moving. Because it's, what, like, 2.5 hours?
It's 2.5 hours. It was a long-ass movie.
What the fuck?
But it fucking moves. That movie does not slow down for anything. It is constantly pushing forward.
Like, Hateful Eight move?
No, it's the High Five moves, actually.
Yes. Yeah. High Five.
That was a book joke.
No, I was just saying, Hateful Eight was, like, 3 hours. It did not feel like 3 hours. So that's my standard.
So another mechanical change in the game is that in the book, you had to get a key. And then the key unlocked a gate. And you had to complete both of those challenges and do that 3 times for the bronze key, the jade key, and the crystal key. In the movie, you just get the key and that's it. So, like, you get the key, there's no gate challenge.
Well, the gate shows up, and when you open a gate, it gives you a clue to the next key.
Dope, dope.
They basically cut the amount of work for the Easter egg hunt in half in the movie, again, probably for economy. But I think by changing them, they also were able to distribute all the geeky stuff in the book equally over the movie. Because the first challenge was a big action game with old movie references. The second challenge, they had to go through a reenactment of the movie The Shining.
Which I did like, but also, like, I don't know.
That's funny.
So I'm gonna talk a little bit about this in the debate, but they went through the movie The Shining, and then they had to basically solve a riddle with a dance of zombies to get the key. And then at this point, in the book, the characters did not meet up until the very end. They're real-life versions. They never really met in person. In the movie, they meet right in the middle of the film.
Okay.
They meet very quickly, and that is part of pushing the plot forward. The character of Artemis, Samantha, summons them all to the same place, and that gets them in the same place. Whereas in the movie, it's like,
right,
we drove 13 hours across the country to Oregon, and Shoto flew in from Japan. So I'm like, yeah, that was probably not a good way to handle that in a feature film. There's less urgency to that. But I think
for this flight, it only takes 13 hours.
Let's just do the movie Inception during the flight from LA to...
Let's watch it 3 times.
So where I think the movie really stakes itself is in the idea that it wants to preserve all the elements of the book, but it shuffles them around for the sake of telling a coherent story. So, like, in the book, you have a character named Irock, who's just this annoying guy who sells information on Wade Watts to the bad guy. And in the movie, they straight up made him a fucking, like, mercenary working for the bad guy. And he's a way more interesting character in the movie, mostly because he's played by TJ Miller, and it totally shines through, and he's a fantastic actor.
I liked when he, like, shat the crystal ball out of his skull face in his stomach.
Yep. Now, the climax of the film is remarkably similar to the book, where there's this castle with the final key in it, or it's a gate in the book, but in the movie it's the key, the final key.
Dope.
There's a magical artifact that is blocking it off, and one of the characters has to break in to IOI to turn it off from the inside, and then they have to storm the castle, and they have a huge army of all the people in the Oasis fighting the Sixers and fighting IOI. And it doesn't go, like, shot for shot the way the book did, but it is very much the same feel. It's just a giant, massive video game battle. The thing that you, like, would love to see in a video game, but you're not going to see unless you play EVE Online, and I'm not spending that kind of money. So
same. Or wait for Star Citizen. Joke's on you.
Mark Hamill's going to be in it. Mark Hamill. So the...
He still listens to our podcast.
Yay! So the movie, what I think does much better than the book is it focuses on the humanity of it. I think one of my biggest gripes about the book, and I mentioned this in an earlier episode that, Laura, you were in, I really enjoy the plot of the book, and I enjoy the setting. I enjoy the implications of everything that's happening, and I like what it did. I do not like one bit the way it was written. Mm. I found its imagery to be flat. I found its language to be...
contrived.
Not even contrived, written by a 13-year-old. Like, the language is all very correct and precise, so it feels like a 13-year-old wrote it and an editor went over the book. So it's like this fantastic idea that I didn't think was written very well, because me, as a mega nerd, and I'm reading just, like, there's an entire chapter of the book, it's like chapter 5 or 6, that's just the characters of H and Wade, Parzival, spouting off trivia at each other.
Yeah.
And... that is not a compelling way to generate character. There is one scene in the film where they do that. One scene, and it's a charming scene, where Parzival and Artemis are talking, and H is, like, noticing that, you know, Parzival's heart is beating fast, and he has a crush, and he's really excited, and Artemis just does not give a fuck even a little. And it's, like, a really sweet moment layered on top of trivia, so it very effectively shows what the entire book spends a ton of time doing in about 30 seconds. And as far as the representation of geek media in the book, it's a lot wider than just 80s. And I think that any complaint that this doesn't represent Ernest Cline's work is kind of out the window, because Ernest Cline wrote this movie. But, like, you also have to consider licensing.
I mean, I'm not arguing that it doesn't.
Oh, no, but, like, I know that is, like, a frequent, you know, counterpoint to, you know, movie adaptations.
All right, wrap it up, Colin.
I have a minute and 45 seconds.
Oh, hey, Keenan, let's talk for a minute and 45 seconds, shall we?
Sure, totally.
So the movie does a much better job of focusing on the human aspects, particularly when it comes to Halliday.
Oh, I hated Halliday.
Their understanding of Halliday in the book is we need to memorize everything he memorized. In the movie, it focuses on this very awkward, timid man and his social struggles, and how he couldn't understand and connect with people. I think the point of the movie falls a little flat, because, like, at the end of the movie, you know, they get the key, Wade wins the Oasis, but the final moment is him speaking to a program left by Halliday, and discovering that Halliday's like, yeah, I made this game because I had trouble connecting with people, but connecting with people is kind of, like, the point of everything. And to that end, it articulates it well. I think it undermines itself by, like, being a movie glorifying video games and nostalgia and nerd stuff, and then at the end being like, but the real world's where it's at.
Mm.
The real world.
I think the book did a better job of that, actually, of lining that up.
I feel like that never really lined up, but by trimming out just the long laundry list of geek, you know, trivia, by focusing on the humanity of the characters, even though it didn't have time to fully explore them, and honestly, by being a visual medium that can show all this stuff efficiently instead of using dry, rote language with such little expressiveness and intent and innovation, I think the movie is more entertaining than the book. Now my time's up, Keenan. Eat a fucking dick.
Oh, sorry. Do you want me to give you a warning of 30 seconds or 2 minutes? Yeah, shut the fuck up. All right, now that each of our representatives have sort of made an opening remark, let's get down to the down and dirty and really see who's right and who's wrong and who's me, which is somewhere in the middle. So let's begin with Laura. I have a question I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
All right, so from my understanding of both the film and the book, it includes a lot of, as we've discussed, like 80s imagery from movies, video games.
It does.
And, you know, comics and stuff, right? Would you say that's accurate?
I would say that's very accurate, yes.
All right. One of, like, the reviews that I read said the title was like a love letter to the 80s. Now, if it took all this inspiration from visual mediums, how can then a written work of literature represent those mediums?
I mean, Colin is right in that some of it can feel kind of dry if you're just reading on the page. I will admit that I think that listening to the audiobook of this is probably the best medium, because it's read by Will Wheaton, And Will Wheaton does a fan-fucking-tastic job of bringing life to some of those drier moments. Like, there's a lot in the book where it has, like, a chat message between Artemis and Parzival, which is not super interesting to read their back and forth, but the way that Will Wheaton reads it kind of brings it a little bit more to life and makes it a little bit more interesting. So, the way that it really kind of is a love letter to the 80s nostalgia is by hammering home, like, every single line in that book has some sort of reference to something super 80s, whether or not that is a video game or a piece of music or movie or TV or the way that Wade spends his time. Everything is so focused on the 80s culture to an extent where I think that it's a little bit weird in the story that somebody, like, a whole culture is that obsessed with 80s, that it's that prevalent. But because it's mentioned in every single line, you just fall into that space and you just are there. Like, you inhabit that space. And I think that the way that it was written out and the way that it was read by Will Wheaton actually made me feel more like I was in that 80s nostalgic world than I did watching the movie. Even though there were tons of visual references to the 80s all over the place, it still really felt like a different time and a different place in a way that the book didn't to me, even though they were very similar in the way that they kind of represent this place that could be anything. I don't know if that really makes any sense, but it just, the book hit you over the head over and over and over. And because you're reading it, you can't just ignore the background image that had something to do with the 80s. Like, you had to read that. And so every time there was a mention of it that was super 80s, you were in that moment.
All right. I just want to clarify some points just a little bit, just to make sure. So what you're saying, Laura, is that the book tried to embody not only the visuals, but a lot of the culture.
Yeah.
And it did that better than the movie.
I felt that way. I'm sure that a lot of people don't, but that's how okay. I felt, yes.
All right. Kellen.
So, I think that trying to write a novel to share your passions with the world is bold and interesting, but I don't think that the book does a fantastic job of inviting you into these things. I find a lot of the descriptions of these different points of geekdom and as specific franchises and things, I find them all to be pretty spiritless and uninviting, and I'm a Star Trek fan. There's a section in chapter 5, chapter 6, like, where he's just going through geek trivia, and he's like, Star Trek, TOS, TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and even Enterprise, and I watched the movies too, phaser set to stun. And it's like, I'm like, I know all of those things. If you don't know those things, that paragraph means nothing to you, and it is never explained and never gone into. And that's how almost all of this stuff is treated. Unless a specific piece of media in the book is used for, unless it's used for an actual challenge or game, it doesn't really bear itself out. It just becomes a list of details.
That's true, but it's also enough that they go into enough detail in the gates and in the challenges that I got more out of it than I would have expected on games that I didn't know, like Joust and mm-hmm. Adventure and all these things. But it was enough that it kept me in that space. Like, the listing did keep me in the space.
Those are the things that took me out of it.
Yeah.
All right, so you're arguing that it lacked context.
I think that it gave context that it was geeky and that it was popular and that the reader should like it. I don't think it ever, and it shouldn't take the time to explain every single individual thing and why it's valuable. I think that that's just a flawed way to write a book in general. Not that he didn't do it well. He did it as best as he could. I just think the idea is not great to start with. Where I think a movie can tackle this better is, whereas a book needs to take paragraphs to write all this shit out and put it into the context of text, in a movie, you can have a single frame, a single image with dozens of references all over it. And especially in, like, the final battle, you see a shot with Mechagodzilla, a Gundam, Serenity from Firefly, Master Chief, Tracer, the Iron Giant. There's so much going on at once. And it's like, if you don't know what all that stuff is, cool. The movie doesn't have a lot of points where it introduces something you don't know and leaves you in the dark. And I think the example I want to point out is the second challenge where they're going through The Shining.
Okay.
I have not seen The Shining. I have not read The Shining. And when they said, we're doing The Shining, and they opened into the movie, I had the same feeling I had in the book where I'm like, I don't fucking know what this is. This is going to be fucking boring. I'm not going to have no connection to it. But they did something smart. The character of H sits up behind them. He's like,
but I've never seen The Shining. What's going on?
Classic.
And the camera follows H through it for like the next 5 minutes, and everybody is like, where the hell did he go? But it takes you through introducing like what The Shining is. Instead of trying to say, this is a thing you should like, it says, this is the experience it gives you.
All right.
The movie had the ability to do that in ways that the book never did, and I think that that scene is the greatest triumph of that. So that's kind of my big counterpoint to those lists of geek trivia.
All right, so you're saying that while the book would say the Iron Giant, if you didn't know what the Iron Giant was, that wouldn't really give you a lot. However, in the movie, you still got to see a giant robot.
Yeah, and I think that concept just lends itself better to a screen.
Okay, all right. Now, you touched on something a little bit.
Yes, I did.
That I wasn't super prepared for, but I kind of like what you were saying, Matt. You didn't think Ernest Cline was that skilled of a writer, right, basically?
Correct.
In which case, do you think then that a part of the success of the movie is based on the fact that the movie was made by a superior storyteller? Like a superior artist, so that the ideas that Ernest Cline was trying to get across were just able to be fabricated better?
I'm going to answer that in a second. I mentioned to Laura at the start of this recording that I had 2 minutes left of exercise on my watch. In sitting here recording this podcast, I have completed those 2 minutes of exercise. So thank you, Apple Watch, for recognizing my passion as exercise. Anyway, so I say a lot. I'm not a big Spielberg fan. I very much respect what he's done. But like The Goonies and Jurassic Park, I think they're really good. Honestly, I really like Jurassic Park. So the contrast I want to make is Jurassic Park is a movie with like a commentary. Michael Crichton was involved, so a lot of that kind of carried through. But a movie like The Goonies, I don't like that, you know, believe in yourself, happy ending for the sake of happiness.
Lame.
Which Ready Player One almost had. It really almost had that. And I felt the Spielberg, and I think he sidestepped some of it enough. But I don't necessarily love Spielberg, but I don't think it's really a question that he does know how to make a movie that focuses on character. And Ernest Cline was one of the two writers on this script. There was a fun anecdote I read, I think on Cinema Blend, talking about Ernest Cline was saying, yeah, we were trying to get him to put all these references in the movie, but he hates referencing his own stuff. You have no idea how much we had to go through to get him to put the Jurassic Park dinosaur in there.
That's
like,
funny.
He's so against navel gazing in that way. And I think a big limit to the amount of references they put in the movie also has to do with licensing, which is that's just something you can't sidestep. So, like, video games were basically reduced to Overwatch and Halo, and everything else was kind of there,
which I thought was a huge shame, because it was like, I mean, Pac-Man like should have been in there, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but it's like at that point you're already licensing out to Microsoft and to Blizzard, and now you have to license out, what do you got to get Bandai Namco in there? And it's just the cost would add up so much on top of everything they already had.
And that is part of my question on like, why would you make a movie out of something that is literally a giant text of licensing issues? Like, what are you going to gain? And I get that you're going to get a lot of visuals.
They were able to cut out a lot of the unnecessary stuff.
Well, and then it made it feel much less 80s like that, though.
There's no need to fit such a crazy long list into a film because the list itself is not interesting. What people do with the list is interesting.
But what people want out of nostalgia is that visual of the things that they like and the things that they miss. And a lot of that was like, imagine if Pac-Man had been in that movie. It would have just made it. Like, that is such an intense visual and such an intense part of a culture that, like, should have been in this movie, right? Like, there's a major plot point where the quarter that he gets is by playing a perfect game of Pac-Man, and it's just, like, such an 80s thing to do, right? And there were all these references to games that are like that and those old arcade games that, like, almost none of them showed up. At the very end, there was one scene with arcades, but, like, arcades were a huge part of the book.
All right.
They were, but if you're thinking about script economy and how you're going to divide that into a movie, arcade games came up at least 3 different major plot points with long sequences describing how they work, with Joust, with Pac-Man, and with Adventure. In the movie, the only one that makes it through, they mention Joust, and they show some other, like, Atari games, but Adventure's the only one they spend time in, and that's to hammer home the point of the Easter egg. But they had to get everything else in the movie. They had to get a movie in there, and that was The Shining. They had to get a modern game in there, and that was The Race. They had to get a classic game in there, and that was Adventure. You don't have the script economy to do that. I don't even think you can make a TV series interesting and have all those different things in there, unless that's like a unifying theme, but it's about so much more than arcade games.
That is still my major reason for questioning why somebody would want to make a movie out of this then, though.
Okay.
Like, if you know that you're going to have to cut out so much of that, then, like, why not just leave
it? Because look at all the stuff that they got in there. You still had an visually absolutely stunning movie, which I don't think that this is.
It was visually.
Well, let's kind of move on from the licensing issue. Although, good discussion. Mm-hmm. There's still, like, a few more points that I think we can talk about. So this one, God. Yeah. Yes. I've spoken. And I shall speak again. Anyway. Now, Colin.
Yes.
There is, like, okay, because it's a movie in this modern day and age, and because it's so streamlined, do you feel at any point that less of the movie was about this? Because I hear, you know, both of you talk about the story of Ready Player One. Now, do you think, and by, like, watering down the story, do you think that reduced the movie to a more of a spectacle where you could just kind of see, like, Superman hanging out with, you know, Tracer and fighting a bunch of robots? Do you think that by doing, like, watering it down, it just became a spectacle of nostalgia rather than an intriguing story that people seem to like?
God, I'm very glad you asked this question. I have a prepared answer, our Lord and Savior, that I would like to present to you now. I think that the strongest counter-argument to the movie that could have been made about the book is that the movie does not fully represent the complex ideas embodied in the book regarding socioeconomic development, power of technology over other things, the personal relationships developed within this context, and the value of life in regard to these things, given that in the book characters die that do not die in the film. However, I do not think the book ever goes into enough detail on any of this to have made a substantial statement that it would feel like it's missing from the movie. Because I remember watching the movie and thinking, man, they didn't include, you know, the ideas about how the energy crisis is affecting people and how IOI has a stake in that and why Samantha/Artemis is so impassioned by this. And after I had that reflexive, meh, the movie missed this thing thought, I thought, but wait a second, the book didn't fucking do it either. It mentioned it, but it never actually explored the ideas. Like I said, I like the setting of the book of Ready Player One. I don't think it ever really took the time to explore those things. So while I think you can easily make the argument that this is a watered-down version of the book, and in some ways it is, it has to be, because it's a movie, and this is the nature of it. We very rarely get adaptations that capture 100% of a book. It's extraordinarily difficult. But it captured the essence, and I think the only reason it did that is because the book missed out on painting bigger ideas. What we get in the movie is definitely streamlined.
So,
and I think that's only better because there's not a lot to miss.
So one of the things that I was really, really missing out of the movie that 100% I think fit into the book was the stakes. This movie felt like there were no stakes. Even though there were, you know, evil bad guys that were trying to take over corporations and they really did blow up his aunt's stack and kill her, like that actually happened.
That's rough.
But they made it into a joke. Like Wade was on the phone with his aunt's shitty boyfriend and his shitty boyfriend was like making a joke about never wanting to hear his voice again and then got exploded. And the film treated it like a joke. And Colin is right. They left out some other deaths where Daito is this huge character in the book and in the movie, but in the book, he gets murdered by getting thrown out of a window because the stakes so high in the book's world that IOI really is willing to do anything. And it just felt like the movie toned that down, made it much more comedic, and, you know, made it feel more like a kid's environment that felt friendlier to smaller children, where I think the book really was more of a younger adult or like early teenager setting. And I walked out of that movie theater really feeling like they made it into a big joke, really, which I enjoyed. I had a great time watching this movie. I really enjoyed it. But I felt like the book was so much more, like the kids had to be smart. They had to make really risky decisions.
It had more gravitas.
It had way more higher stakes.
I agree with you on paper, again, coming from the fact that he wrote these things out. And I think that the lack of killing Daito was probably a sticking point for me with the movie as well, because that did add a lot of serious connection to the dangerous context.
Like he was just smiling at the end, like, "Oh, this is great," and I was like,
"Yeah." And Daito was just like a fun little guy. He was really fun in the movie. Yeah. The few bits he had, that little kid owned it. But I'm so sorry. I think that one of the issues with the book, and I haven't articulated this specifically, but in its lack of everything that I've said, I think one thing it lacks is tone. I don't think the book has a good sense of tone. It's never really conveying a singular attitude. Something from the book that I would like to read really quickly. Give me a moment. I have it bookmarked. In the movie, they don't take a lot of the time for, like, you know, impassioned speeches. They get one or two. But in the book, after, you know, all these people have been killed and all this shit is going on, Wade says, "Sorrento had tried to kill me, and in the process, he'd murdered my aunt, along with several of my neighbors, including sweet old Mrs. Gilmore, who had never hurt a soul. He'd also had Daito killed, and even though I'd never met him, Daito had been my friend." There is no style. There is no passion. There is no personality behind that. Just like all the geek media, he's listing these things that it's expecting you to feel. And that's why, even though I understand that as a plot point, I think this adds a lot of compelling qualities to the story, I don't feel as though the movie missed out on it because the book failed to allow me to connect with it. That paragraph is what made me realize I don't actually love this book.
Yeah,
is what really crystallized it. And the movie painted a picture to me that it's okay to leave those behind because I think the book failed. Mm.
And I do really truly believe that reading this book versus listening to the audiobook did 100% influence my opinion of the writing. Fair. I do not think it's the best writing. It is not my favorite book. I enjoyed listening to it very much. But I do think that a lot of that was on listening to Will Wheaton read it, because he did make it feel like, in his tone and through his voice acting abilities, like he was able to really make their relationship a real one. And so when he was saying that, you know, Daito, even though I've never met him, he was my friend, felt really true and really real. And so the stakes of him being killed felt a lot stronger than it sounds like you had that connection to. And on a side note, listening to Will Wheaton read was exactly like listening to you if you had read this book to me. Like, it was...
What a wholesome thing to say.
It was hilarious. I was thinking, like, Colin Ketchin is reading me this book right now, and it's fucking weird.
So actually, Keenan, I have a question for you then before we move on to the listener questions and whatever else you have planned in the closing statements. Because Laura's representing the book, but she's listened to the audiobook and I've read the book, and that gives us different experiences of this.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you plan to calculate this into your decision as far as how we're representing our domains, because I think she's doing an excellent job of representing her position, but I don't know if her position is exactly something I have the ability to compare against, nor mine her.
I would say that, because I was thinking about that sometimes when you were discussing it, that I was saying that there is a difference between the book and the audiobook itself, as well as the movie compared to the audiobook, I'm sure, is different than the movie compared to just the regular book. I've been trying to base it more off what Laura's been saying about the book itself.
Okay.
And you bring up good points about the audiobook. I'm a big believer in audiobooks. I mean, my father is dyslexic and he had a lot of trouble reading a lot of books. So when audiobooks became really popular, my father was able to have access to loads more books than he probably would be able to have read as well because of his dyslexia. And I love them too. But I do think that in the course of this Versus episode, you did unfortunately give some ground to Colin. But I also did like how you, because you would say, you know, well, this is a flaw of the book. But I did like how you said, well, that isn't necessarily the book's fault, kind of a
thing.
And
I do think, I think Will Wheaton does a really excellent job of reading and acting it. But I do think that if you're reading a book, like, the thing about books is that your imagination is really the limit to it. So, like, the world that's built around it and those emotions and the connections, like, yeah, having Will Wheaton read that to me in a specific way influenced the way that I read it. But that doesn't necessarily mean I wouldn't have read it similarly in my own head, too. I just don't know because I didn't have that experience.
It's as impassioned as you allow it to be.
Right.
So, Keenan, do you have any other questions before we do the listener questions and then closing arguments?
No, I think I'm good so far, with this. So, without further ado, real quick, guys, for all listeners out there, we got some listener questions for today's episode. If you want to submit one of your own, you can comment on our weekly Facebook posts or send us an email at commongeekingprogram@gmail.com. Now, let's take a look at some of those questions. And most access to both. Coming from Manny Peralta,
reading
which
reading.
Sounds like an amazing young man who has some very intelligent questions. Number one, let's talk about how deep does the love story go in the book versus the movie?
Laura?
I actually think that they went more into the love story in the movie than they did the book. The book had a one-sided super crush for a really long time, and at the very end there's payoff. In the movie, because the characters were interacting a little bit more frequently, they definitely went into more of the love story in the movie. Also, they spent more time physically together in the movie. Like, mm-hmm. In the real world.
Yep.
In the movie.
All right.
Yeah, I agree. And, like, a lot of the first act of the film, a pacing issue I had with the movie was that there was, like, this big breakup between Artemis and Parzival that felt like, this feels like something that happens at the end of the rom-com, and it's been, like, 30 minutes. but it served to set the stage for them to meet up later. So the pace was weird, but I think it did allow them to focus in on it a little better than the book did. Because the book basically ends by saying that they like each other.
Yeah.
That happens a lot sooner.
That's cute.
It's got that Spielberg, you know, nice, happy, tinkly
feel.
Yeah,
all right. next question, which I believe we already covered, is are there more games, events, challenges in the books versus the movie? And we kind of established that there are more in the book, just because you can list things easier than having to pay for the rights to make CGI of them.
But the movie came up with its own, which I think, despite whether you like one over the other, I think it's nice that the book was different while maintaining a lot of the same core elements, because it allowed you to still be surprised.
All right.
And I mean, honestly, seeing the movie, it is nice to see some of those extra things and some of the visuals that they were able to pull together. I preferred the book, surprise, surprise, but like the movie did a really great job of kind of making it its own thing.
All right, that's good. That's good. And then his final question was, do they go deeper into how the past affected the present in the book?
A little bit, yeah. Like, there's a little more discussion over the energy crisis and kind of how people ran out of money to pay for gas, and so they would just leave their cars everywhere and kind of world building at the beginning. But once that happened, I would say that not much more happened. So the book goes into a little bit more detail, but not by a whole lot, I would say. I think they did a great job in those 5 minutes really building the world. Similarly to the book.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, I honestly agree with that. I agree with that 100%.
Groovy. All right, well, thank you, Manny Peralta, for sending us those questions. Feel free to try again and get another shout-out from your Lord and Savior, me, in a future episode, or from one of these peasants.
L&S me is what you'll see on Keenan's business cards.
Yeah. So, now that I've had you two kind of battle it out for a little bit, I would like to close the debate now. I've heard your pieces, and now I would like you both to have... I'm going to give you both 30 seconds to issue a closing statement before we proceed to the ratings. So, who would like to go first?
Oh, well, same order. Laura's going to go first.
Yeah, I'll keep going first, yeah.
Okay, go.
So, I believe the book was better because the kids had to be smart and they had to be skillful. They had to work really hard. They had to come up with risky plans, like how to infiltrate and not accidentally get locked up in IOI. And I felt like the stakes were much higher. The deaths were real, and it made a big difference in my experience of the book. So I believe the book was more meaningful than the movie.
All right. Good. All right. Colin.
All right. Ready Player One as a novel takes an exclusionary stance by bombarding the reader with spiritless trivia, the delivery of which is hollow unless the reader shares the passion for these things as the author. The film is a nonstop action film with all the pros and cons of that format, but it is stunningly beautiful, which cannot be ignored or understated, and that just serves as a platform for Wade Watts and his friends to go on insane adventures. Its missteps and pacing are made up for with legitimate surprises, fun characters, and an ending that focuses more on humanity and connection than anything else. As a result, the movie Ready Player One
unites
the core passions.
You're over.
Okay.
And I told you in the past that it was amazing and compelling.
Your point has been made in the presence of the divine, so all is heard.
I knew that paragraph I wrote was a little long. God damn it.
It was a little long.
God damn it.
Now, let's talk about ratings. Now, let's talk about ratings.
Let's not do the rating section. Let's talk about ratings.
I would like to talk about ratings. I'm listening to Friendly Fire, and they just stole our ratings system.
They absolutely did. It's too bad they're really famous, and we're really not, so we don't really have a claim. Except we also started an episode motherfucking three, so they can get on our level.
I know, right?
Adam and Ben.
I love you guys.
True. I actually love you guys.
You're my favorite.
What if Friendly Fire is just stealing ideas movies from lesser-known podcasts this whole time, and they're not actually really original. They just listen to obscure podcasts and steal their ideas. Those bastards will be smited. Anyway, now, on a scale of 1 to 5 keys, how do you guys feel about how the other did?
I suppose I'll start. I would give Colin 4 out of 5 keys. He is a man who thinks a lot about his words before he says them.
I'm a man.
You're a man? I guess I can't say that. I don't know for sure. You can say whatever you are. No, but I think that Colin is really passionate about what he talks about. I was actually really nervous to be in a Versus episode with him because I am not nearly as passionate about anything as he is about his nerd stuff. But I think he did a really great job of defending his feelings about the movie, and I'm happy to say we will continue to agree to disagree about which we find better.
I think that's fair.
What an amicable ending. Nice.
Die, Colin, die!
You want to try that word again, Keenan?
Amicable? One to be a way to be admirable? See, we all know words are just funny things. The vernacular is silly.
Oh, good grief.
Anyway.
So, okay. My turn. Laura, I would also like to rate you 4 out of 5 keys.
Oh, thanks,
God. I was really prepared to rate you 3 out of 5 just because that's how I feel about the book at this point. The movie kind of lessened my appreciation for it. But you surprised me with some of your viewpoints, in particular your view of the children and them needing to be like smart and things like that.
It's a big part of the book.
Maybe not something I placed a lot of value on because I'm a robot. But I think that your position also comes from an equal point of passion, maybe not as obsessive as mine, but I want to let you know, I wasn't necessarily nervous to debate you because I debate a lot of people and I'm just fucking used to losing arguments and winning them. It's fine.
Way to cover your bases. I wasn't nervous. I want to make that perfectly clear.
I was fucking ready, but I was really excited because I know that even though you are not passionate, you are very intelligent and capable of breaking things apart in ways that I may not consider. And this has been actually very nice.
Now I, your Lord and Savior, the messenger of the divine on earth, will give you both. Well, really, one
of
you.
Nope, just one of us.
Oh, just one of us. This is a versus. We're fighting.
Well, you both get the pleasure of knowing that the other is better or worse, so that's nice. I will award you your very own Easter egg.
Ooh. Nice.
Yeah, right? I guess it makes sense. Fucking topical, right?
Oh, we never answered it. It was an Easter egg in the movie, but it wasn't in the book. It was physically an egg in the movie.
Nice. Anyway. I like it. I was worried that at the end it'd be like, oh, that? Ah, you found it. Inside all of you coming together. I was like, is it just friendship? I bet it's just friendship.
It was friendship the whole time.
I was the egg the whole time.
Yeah, basically. Now, what I did, because I know you guys expressed some, you know, concern over how I was, you know, judging you guys. Basically, whenever a topic came up and you two kind of went at it, I kind of tallied over who I thought made a better argument about it.
Okay.
And the person who ended up having more tallies in the end...
Oh boy, I'm actually nervous.
By not a large margin. I want to make that clear that you both did pretty well. This was a tough decision.
I'm like actually nervous, holy shit.
Was Colin.
Yes! Oh boy.
Overall, Colin's argument of Steven Spielberg versus Ernest Cline that the book was a fundamentally flawed medium... that even though the movie was flawed in itself, it still improved upon the already problematic original score. Was a big, you know, reoccurring theme that he argued really well. However, I thought that a lot of what you argued, Laura, was pretty good, especially when concerning about, like, licensing. I actually really liked when you said, well, when you get right down to it, it simply cannot fully represent most of the subject matter. And also talking about a lot of the subject matter in and of itself, like about the gravitas of it, you know?
I was like really nervous when you asked me that question about licensing. That felt like a gut punch. I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah, no, like I said, like you both had really good points. It just, I think this time it just happened to end up being Colin. And unfortunately, as I said before, Laura, you did kind of give him some ground by admitting that the book wasn't that good sometimes.
But she couldn't lie to L ampersand S me.
Yeah, or me, God. Which I respect.
Well, yeah, I was quoting your business card because you are Lord and Savior Keenan.
A penitent man will pass. That's what I should have just been doing this whole time. I should have just been sprinkling 80s references in, you know? I really wasted this episode. Guys, you know what we're doing? You know, scrap the whole episode. It's done. I ruined it. So I just want to say, like I said, Laura, you did really well. And I honestly, this was a tough call.
Well, I'm disappointed, but I appreciate it.
Keenan, I would like to say thank you very much for this prestigious egg. And I also want to say on record, I hosted the first Versus, and I was in a Versus, and I have developed the Versus format.
This is my first Versus.
This has been my favorite.
Aww.
Thing is, okay, so fun behind the scenes for the audience. We planned this before the movie came out.
Yeah.
When I had not finished the book, and Laura hadn't listened to it in a while, and we didn't know what we were going to think. We took this position. We just assumed I would like the movie and she would like the book.
Pretty ballsy.
Yeah.
Thank the good Lord that it worked out that way. She texted me this morning like, yeah, man, the book was better. And I was like, oh, it's going to be a good episode. And you know what? It fucking was.
Yeah, it's good that just like the movie wasn't just a complete bomb. And you were like, well, I mean, I had to pay $12 to see it. So that means it's better, right?
Yeah.
Now, that about wraps it up. Thank you for listening to the Common Geeking Program. Once again, I am your host, your Lord, your Savior, your God, Keenan Koish, and you can find me within yourself if you look hard enough. Please, type in, go online and find the Church of Kodesh and donate as much as you can, whether it's money, your life, or all your earthly possessions.
Listeners, we are not within you.
Again, I have been joined by...
I have been Laura Kramer.
Where can we find you? Hopefully not inside of us.
Nope, can't do that. you can find me on the Common Geeking Program Facebook. I don't really social media so much.
I am Colin Ketchin, and you can find me at Sana Colin K on a lot of platforms like Facebook and Twitter.
Next week, our episode will actually be hosted by Laura here. Laura, tell us a little bit about the episode.
By me, yeah. Next week, we'll be talking about TV show intros, and I am having our lovely representatives watch Altered Carbon and how that TV intro kind of represents the show as a whole. So yeah, TV intros.
Be sure to tune in next Friday at May 4th to check that out. And follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Geeking Program. Any engagement such as sharing a post, tagging us, or tweeting hashtag CGP will enter you into a raffle where you can get to pick a topic for a future episode. Reviewing us on Apple Podcasts is a critical help in growing our show, and we'll read new reviews on the air. Anyway, thanks for listening, subscribing, sharing, everything, worshiping, and we'll talk to you next week.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Be well.
Wank.
This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by Keenan Koish, joined by the representatives Laura Kramer and Colin Ketchin. This episode is sponsored by the ancient cosmic entity known as Orgalorg. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Jeff, as well as Austin Liebers and Laura Kramer, with original music by Colin Ketchin. Next week, we'll be talking about TV show intros and Altered Carbon, so be sure to tune in for that on May 4th. And as always, thank you for listening to this.
Welcome to the Common Geeking Program, a book cub podcast where each of us...
A book cub.
A book cub!
Is a little a-bay fuzzy book.
It's just a little tiny cub.
Little scratch him under the chin.